You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world.
Section 101 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. We're going to read through it and we're going to figure it out. Go ahead.
101, from early on, the great simplicity. From early on, the great simplicity of the first beginning of the thinking of the truth of being must stand clearly in a sure light. What does it mean and what does it ground that being is placed as physis into the Greek word for truth of, is that logos and another Greek word?
Yeah, logos, and I thought we read that word last time.
Thinking.
Logos and thinking, yeah. Logos and thought.
And thought.
Language and thought, in a sense. Mm-hmm. So let's read that again and just skip the Greek words and just give us the translations.
Okay. From early on, the great simplicity of the first beginning of the thinking of the truth of being must stand clearly in a sure light. What does it mean and what does it ground that being is placed as nature into the truth of words and thought? The illumination of this beginning must have previously renounced bringing into play as an interpretative resource all that arose only from the inability to master the beginning and from the collapse of Greek for truth. Then we have a lot of Greek words, which you're going to decode.
Yeah, so I think it's thinking as thought of the look of a vision, the sight of a vision. And then we have common and logos, or I would say sort of the common language, the common discourse as assertion of the categories. I think that's what it basically puts forth in Greek there. Yeah, okay, go ahead. Then we'll look at this whole section.
In the confrontation with the first beginning, however, the inheritance first becomes an inheritance, and the future ones first become inheritors, which they never become merely through the accident of being later ones.
Yeah. So, from early on, the great simplicity of the first beginning of the thinking of the truth of being must stand clearly in a sure light. So, this the first beginning of the thinking of the truth of being, which I think, in a sense, we're in. So that's not, I don't think that's the first beginning in the Greek as the origin of Greek metaphysics. I think that's the great simplicity of how we are beginning to think of the truth of being, right?
Yeah.
And that great simplicity is, he says, I would say he kind of correlates with the question of what does it mean and what does it ground that being is placed as nature into the truth of logos and thought. Right? Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of, I would say that's a nice summary of the question he's thinking is kind of formative and grounding of the first beginning of the thinking of the truth of being. And that its great simplicity lies in kind of asking that question. What does it mean and what does it ground? What does it make necessarily true that being is placed as nature, or in a sense, substance is placed as fundament into the truth of logos and thought. So being has a kind of it's the nature, and I think that, you know, I mean, there's synonyms for that word. Is sort of, it's the essence, it's the substance, it's mm-hmm. the core, it's the defining trait, the common trait. Being is kind of this foundation, and it's inserted as the foundation into the truth of logos and thought. Logos and thought are true, and their truth is to be understood as having something to do with being. The illumination of this beginning must have previously renounced. So this beginning that we're involved in, right? Mm-hmm. Its illumination, sort of its coming into the light, is only possible because it previously renounced bringing into play, in other words, engaging with as an interpretative resource, all that arose only from the inability to master the beginning and from the collapse of truth. So its illumination only occurs because it refuses to kind of bring into play everything that came about from the previous inability to master the beginning. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a inability at the core of this new beginning, which is that we look back and we see there was an inability to master some things, meaning the beginning that we haven't undertaken. So there's an ineptitude, there's a lack in the past prior to us. The inability to master the beginning and from the collapse of truth. Meaning, again, he's kind of harped on this, you know, that the question of truth has been ignored, and how it relates to being and nature and thought and logos and all that. And then he has this colon, the collapse of truth, and he says here in Greek, it's a little cryptic, I mean, because it is in Greek, but... thinking as thought, in a way, or it could be thought as the thinking of the look of a vision, mm-hmm. or the idea of an idea, or the sight, or the seeing of a sight. Mm-hmm. So, again, like, so that's kind of what thought is thought of as, mm-hmm. is an awareness or a cognition or an experience of or a represent or an infusing of or an imbibing of the vision of a vision, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then we have this koivav and logos. I don't know how that's pronounced, but along with thought. Along with the thinking of the vision of a vision as thought, we have this sort of common language, or which could just be simply, you know, group discourse, common discourse, mm-hmm. as an assertion of the categories. Mm-hmm. And categories is, you know, an important word from Aristotle onward, on through Kant, you know, it's one of those words that I identify as integral to identity, right? That mm-hmm. everything gets put into a category, or in other words, into an identity, into an essential group, into a set. Mm-hmm. Individuality is subsumed by a larger abstract definitional realm. So those are just kind of, you know, those are just kind of like aspects, very kind of groovy, cryptic aspects of the collapse of truth. The truth kind of collapses in the face of, in the incidence of this kind of conceptual framework, mm-hmm. right? That thinking has something to do with seeing a vision, or the vision of vision, or the form of forms, or the idea of ideas, and that language is the assertion of categories. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting analysis.
Yeah.
Like, who can make that analysis?
Yeah, right.
I don't know. You know, it's just so deep and niche is the word.
Yeah.
It's niche.
It's like so, yeah. It's like detail. It's just so insanely detailed.
Yeah, insanely detailed, yeah. In the confrontation with the first beginning, however, so again, the first beginning, I think there, that refers back to the Greeks. However, the inheritance first becomes an inheritance. So in confronting the first beginning, we actually inherit it. Mm-hmm. And it becomes an inheritance instead of it becomes an inheritance in the sense that it's a little more overtly and openly given to us and not just covertly and secretly infused into us. Mm-hmm. And the future ones first become inheritors, so we finally inherit it. And we don't simply become inheritors because we are simply after the Greeks. Mm-hmm. We need to, it's not just by being chronologically later, we need to actively confront the first beginning, and that makes us the inheritors of its metaphysics, in a sense of its truths, of its inabilities, etc. It kind of objectifies it and makes it available to us. Yeah.
Should we read on a bit?
I think we should read on. Yeah, of course, it's just so good.
102, thinking, the guideline of the guiding question of Western philosophy. Inceptually, thinking is the anticipatory apprehension and gathering of the unconcealedness of what emerges and is constantly present as such.
Yeah, that's a nice little definition of thinking. Thinking is the anticipatory apprehension. So again, there's always anticipation or projection or fortune telling in thought. And the gathering of the unconcealedness of what emerges and is constantly present as such. So something has to emerge and be constantly present and be unconcealed. Those are three aspects of that which thought kind of gathers into itself and anticipatorily apprehends. Mm-hmm. And he uses this word inceptually, and I think sort of that means sort of like basically, and foundationally, and yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Because aletheia, Greek for truth, nevertheless remains ungrounded and therefore sinks down into correctness, so also thinking as a faculty falls prey to a, quote, psychological, i.e. ontic interpretation. The sinking down into correctness signifies especially, however, when seen with respect to the beginning, that for correctness itself, its own playing field remains ungrounded and constantly disturbed without being recognized for what it is. The relation already prepared by Plato between Greek for soul and Greek for truth as Greek for yoke has become since Descartes the ever sharper subject-object relation. Thinking becomes the I think. The I think becomes I unify originally. I think unity a priori.
Yeah. So truth remains ungrounded, even though, you know, thinking is such and such, anticipatory apprehension, gathering of the unconcealedness of what emerges. But truth remains ungrounded because, again, we haven't really asked what truth is, and therefore sinks down into correctness. So truth loses or never actually attains what Heidegger might call groundedness, and instead just becomes the truth is when you are correct. And so thinking as a faculty of the mind falls prey to a psychological or ontic interpretation. So thinking is thought of then psychologically. So I would say instead of thinking being analyzed in terms of its role in the truth establishment of the of Dasein in Bang, it becomes just a psychological faculty, if in a sense, just a function of the mind, which is why I think he calls it ontic, because in a sense, thinking as a function of the mind, it's a descriptive, we have a descriptive relationship with thinking. We just describe it as an aspect or a feature of the mind, and we don't come to ask what its relationship is and what its role is outside the mind. The sinking down into correctness signifies especially, however, so the sinking away from truth into a dejected correctness, an abject correctness, when seen with respect to the beginning, signifies, when seen with respect to the beginning, that for correctness itself, its own playing field remains ungrounded, and constantly disturbed without being recognized for what it is. So, yeah, the playing field of correctness is ungrounded. It's just, it's kind of a fantasy, kind of an airy fairy, clouds in the sky kind of feature of language. Correctness, it's a little game. It's its own little referential circle jerk. It's an ungrounded festival of symbiotic silliness. The relation already prepared by Plato between, and this is important, soul and truth as yoke. So it's wonderful to see that word yoke there. That's really interesting, right? With yoga. And, you know, yoga seeks to yoke the sort of individual soul with the universal soul. And Plato obviously was on to something similar here with soul and truth. Has become since Descartes, so Plato sort of established this idea of soul and truth yoking. Since Descartes has morphed into the subject-object relation, right? So the soul is the subject, the object is truth. I mean, I think this OV here means being, probably, or about, yeah, being. Mm-hmm. So it's like the I, the subject and the object, right? Mm-hmm. And thinking becomes the I think. So thinking gets absorbed into the I, and just becomes something that the I does, and loses its broader Dasein-ish existential parameters as an evolutionary and a sense of functional surrounding aspect of human being, in a sense the core way human being relates with non-human being. The I think becomes I unify. Originally I think unity, so the I think I becomes I unifying things, I bringing things together, I conceiving of unity, and then the a priori comes along, that which needs no sort of empirical or existential evidence. It becomes an abstract, timeless concept or category. So this little evolution here, fascinating evolution from Plato's talk of yoking the soul and truth, all the way up to the I gaining cognitive power to create unity and absolute truth. Right?
Yeah.
I'm just sort of reminded of, you know, Ziggy Stardust sucking up into his mind. You know, that's in a sense what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thinking is anticipatory granting of presence as such.
Yeah, and that's in italics, so I think he's trying to say, look, despite all this, I think, I unify, I yoke the soul to the truth, I think unity, I create a priori truth. Absence the I, Heidegger says, thinking is basically anticipatory granting of presence as such. So thinking is...
Wait, is this like the new thinking or old thinking?
I think he's kind of saying, you know, despite all this stuff about I think, subject, object, soul, truth, etc., let's get back to what thinking really is. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about thinking apart from correctness or apart from its ontic interpretation or thinking as a psychological, ungrounded faculty of the mind and say, look, for me, Heidegger, in a sense, ontological philosopher, thinking is anticipatory granting of presence as such. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Okay.
It's not just a faculty whereby the I unifies things into a priori concepts.
Mm-hmm.
It's an anticipatory granting of presence. So anticipatory, again, it grants presence ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So think about that and anxiety.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, go ahead.
Yet this relation is only the path on which thinking, by grasping in advance and unifying, posits the unity of what is encountered and so allows this to be encountered as a being. Beings become objects.
Yeah, this relation of granting presence is the path on which thinking, by grasping in advance and unifying, and remember unifying here goes back to our discussion last time about mm-hmm. being in unity, being in the one. So thinking is out here unifying things into units, into ones, so we can call them a being. And it's a gathering and organizing. It's a simplifying. It thinking takes complex clusters of events and substances and qualities and turns them into a one. That's like its role,
mm-hmm.
right? It posits the unity of what is encountered, like I just said, and so allows it to be encountered as a being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this beings become an object via mm-hmm. thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. At first, all efforts then implicitly strive to make this relation itself, thinking as the thinking of the I think something, purely and simply the ground of the beingness of beings, and indeed, through assumption of the inceptual determination of beings as what is. Ev, I believe that's one.
Yeah, what is one? At first, all efforts then implicitly strive to make this relation itself, thinking as the thinking of the I think something, purely and simply the ground of the beingness of beings. So basically it tries to say that thinking as a unity-making action, and thinking as the thinking of the I think something, so thinking as inherently having an object, the effort is to make this fact of thought that thinking thinks things and unifies them into beings as the ground of the beingness of beings. So it tries to say that, well, because I mm-hmm. think of beings and I can unify things into beingness, then that means there is a beingness of beings and it's there because of my thinking. And indeed, it's through an assumption of the inceptual determination of beings as what is one. So all this seems to be a grounding of this idea of beings and the truth of being. And then we have, we start talking about identity.
Yeah.
What do you know?
First time in
yeah.
the book, right? In this manner, identity becomes the essential determination of beings as such.
Yes, because we can identify them, we can give them an identity, and identity determines a being. A being does not exist unless there's an identity, unless we have identified it. Mm-hmm. Another way to put it is no entity without identity. Mm-hmm. That's a phrase from Quine, mm-hmm. That there is no entity without identity.
Mm-hmm. Identity derives from the aletheia of physis, so the truth of nature. From presence as unconcealed gatheredness into unconcealedness.
Yeah. Identity derives from the truth of physis or nature. Yeah. I mean, I guess that as we see truth in nature or assert truths in nature or identify truths in nature, yeah, then we gain identities. I mean, we identify truth. And it derives from presence. So a thing with an identity must be present as unconcealed gatheredness into unconcealedness. So it must appear, it must be gathered into appearance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the modern era, identity attains its preeminence in the I. This I is at once grasped as the preeminent identity, i.e. the identity which is explicitly self-appertaining and which by knowing itself is precisely in this knowledge.
Yeah, the I becomes the epicenter of identity, the preeminent identity. It itself appertains, it pertains to itself, it relates to itself, it knows itself, it exists in a relationship with itself, and it is precisely this knowledge of itself. That's what its identity is. The I knows itself as the I, and that's its identity, and that's what gives it identity, and that's why it demands and procreates and propagates identity.
From here, we can begin to see why knowledge itself becomes the ground of beingness and thus becomes the most proper being, and why, for Hegel, absolute knowledge is the absolute reality.
Yeah, I mean, we can see why, because knowledge, knowing yourself, know thyself, thinking, whose object is knowledge, duty or task is knowledge. From here, we can see why knowledge itself becomes the ground of beingness, right? Like thinking gives ground to being, knowledge gives ground to being because thinking produces knowledge, and thus becomes the most proper being. Knowledge is the most proper being, and we get to the point where, for Hegel, absolute knowledge is absolute reality, which is funny, in a sense, right? That absolute knowledge would be absolute reality. I almost feel like I would almost be compelled to say absolute knowledge is the opposite of absolute reality, but that would require a lot of definitions, so let's keep going.
This history brings to expression in the most acute and unconditional way the dominance of thinking as the guideline for the determination of beingness.
Yeah, it's sort of a concluding statement. We get that.
Owing to the already dominant guideline, knowledge as self-knowledge is the highest identity, the most proper being, and as such dwells at the same time in the possibility of conditioning in its own way as knowledge, all other objectivities, and indeed not only in a comparatively transcendental sense, but as in Schelling, in such fashion that what is other to the eye is itself determined as visible spirit. Thereby now once again and ultimately identity is raised into the absoluteness of indifference, which of course does not mean sheer emptiness.
Yeah. Seems pretty clear, right? Owing to the already dominant guideline, knowledge as self-knowledge is the highest identity, the most proper being. Yeah, I mean, self-knowledge, knowing yourself, or even just the relationship of the I to itself via knowledge, and the mandate of knowledge, and the quest of the I knowing itself. becomes the most proper being. The I becomes the most elevated being, the most highest identity, the central identity, and as such dwells at the same time in the possibility of conditioning in its own way as knowledge all other objectivity. So it becomes the arbiter of objectivity and identity, and indeed not only in a comparatively transcendental sense. So again, we're looking here at the transcendence of the I and the I's objective status above and beyond all lower nature, in such fashion that what is other to the I is itself determined as visible spirit. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's pretty Hegelian there. I mean, I think the I becomes, in a sense, so transcendental and such an arbiter of objectivity that those things that are not the I are not just mere objects or mere banal entities. The I now essentially only interacts with what it views to be appearing spirits, visible spirit, evident spirit. The whole world becomes transcendent in a sense because it's all the eye seeing itself. Thereby now once again and ultimately identity is raised into the absoluteness of indifference. So in a sense, which of course does not mean sure, indifference here, identity is raised into the absoluteness of indifference. That's it. Indifference there could mean indiscernibility, sameness. Identity, things disappear into themselves, into their identity, because they are identical to themselves, or things become identical. And when something is identical to itself or something else, then they, in a sense, collapse into each other and become indifferent, as in non-different from each other. And so all the eyes are the same, all identities are the same, everything becomes the same as everything else, because everything is just an identity generated out of a self knowing itself. AKA liberalism. I mean, really.
Yeah.
AKA that sense you get from liberalism that it is, in fact, a homogenizing, communalizing, standardizing agenda of sameness. And it's because it is essentially the religion of identity. And what we're doing is we're worshiping the indifference of identity, and the world is only safe and sound and progressive, which is another word for safe and sound, if everybody is an identity that is indifferent and equal to all the other identities, because then there are no identities that are different than all the proper identities. So the non-identities, the fragmented identities, the fractal identities, the wrong identities don't fit the identity sameness, the identity indifference, and so they need to be basically shit out and got rid of, because they don't really align with the program of indifference as a community of identities. Right?
Well, maybe we should talk.
Yeah, what are we going to talk about? Did you have something you wanted to talk about?
I say, like, the one thing I really noted was just this first, or one of these first sentences, that inceptually thinking is the anticipatory apprehension and gathering of the unconcealedness of what emerges and is constantly present as such. And that just feels like a really, really accurate description of intrusive thoughts, because and maybe all thinking, but I guess for some reason I feel like intrusive thoughts in particular, perhaps because they are so much about, I feel like, knowing or projecting a scenario, a situation that is in a way almost unquestionable, and is just very like flat and bare and bad. So it just kind of is, it's just very unconcealed. It's very present. And it's an anticipatory apprehension. So it really strikes me as fitting that definition.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe the answer to this is really obvious or simple, but the difference between a non-intrusive thought and an intrusive thought as an experience.
The intrusive thought for me is basically a catastrophic worst case scenario projection based on a being or an object that says, well, what if this terrible thing happens? And then I guess a non-intrusive thought would be just one that's not a worst case scenario.
Okay, that's really interesting, because I don't know if you're allowed to kind of say that intrusive thoughts are like thoughts you don't like, and non-intrusive thoughts are thoughts you do.
That's what they are.
Yeah, but that's not like, that's like saying that all the bad things in my life come from other people.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not to blame for any of them. That's what I wanted to get at is intrusive thought, non-intrusive thought, instead of describing them in terms of their content, describe them as an experience or as a modalically placed event in your design. So, like, does one feel imbued with intentionality and one feels imbued with invasion? Like, is it really a feeling of like there are thoughts that I have that I generated that come from a place in me that feels like an authenticity or an ego or a transcendental I, and then intrusive thoughts feel like echoes that have bounced off the monstrosity of distant aliens that I don't know and never ask to be in my brain?
No, I think that they all feel like they come from me, and that's why they're scary.
So when you have a non-intrusive thought and an intrusive thought, they both feel identical in terms of you having the experience of what we call having a thought.
I think so.
So for instance, if you have this catastrophic thought of like, I'm gonna grab a knife and do something nasty, not nasty, but do something horrible, you know, and I imagine then that thought really kind of like keeps going, right? It's like, yeah. I'm gonna it's like it becomes like a kind of a constant repetition of the same idea. Is that what happens? Well, hold on. Let me finish my question. So, an intrusive thought is the thought of like, I'm gonna do this, or this is gonna happen.
I mean, for me, it's more of a what if. So it's like, what if I did that?
Okay, so you have a thought of like, what if?
Yeah.
So how is that different than what if I went into town earlier today and did my massage before I went to the grocery store?
Mm-hmm.
How's it different as an experience? Like, are both just really juggling options and trying to imagine what it would be like to live through either option? Or is like, what's the experience of these different kinds of thoughts like? How do they play out in your mind, and how do they link, how do they tie into the sense of you cognizing things, thinking things through, or you just having sounds echoing through your mind, or you intentionally deliberating possibilities, or you not being able to control the words that are coming out of your unconscious? Like, what's going on?
I guess I'm not sure where, like, again, I just feel like it's the ones that I call intrusive thoughts are the ones that, I mean, there's often a little lead in that's like, what if something bad happens, or what if I have a thought I don't like, or what if I have a scary thought or something like that, which is sort of a prompt for me to then think of that thought.
And that just pops into your mind all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've become I become a little sensitized to like to that. Yes.
You become sensitive. What do you mean?
I mean, I have like a problem where like I am like, oh gosh, I could worry about something. Okay, let's worry about it.
Okay.
Like I have a bad habit, a bad problem.
Okay, and it pops into your mind, what if? And then what happens? You can't stop from kind of following that train of thought, like being on that train of thought? I mean, sometimes you obviously can, but
I don't know. It depends. Like every variation probably happens.
Because it strikes me that like if the thought you're having is like, well, if I go into town at 9, I could do the massage and then I could go to the grocery store. But if I go into town at 11, I might have to do the grocery store. You know, like there's you know, that kind of thinking. But if I come up to you and I say, stop thinking about that. Mm-hmm. You could just do that, right? You'd be like, oh yeah, I'll table that. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll think about that later. I see you do that all the time. I'll think about, I'm trying to figure this thing out. Right. I'm trying to figure out like why my Instagram views are down, or I'm trying to think about, you know, what would be the best birthday present for our son.
Yeah.
And you think about it a little while and then you move on to something else. And if I were to say to you, why don't you stop thinking about that and we'll talk about it in the pool later.
Yeah.
You would just do that with the snap of a finger.
Yeah.
But the intrusive thought is different, right? Like I can't just snap my fingers and say, okay, stop contemplating that what if. So one is like a compulsion or a repetition or a... Like it's coming from a place different than thought or something.
Yeah.
Is that... Is that the experience you have?
Because I think it becomes like emotionally weighted and intensified by this like fear of the thing happening. So it just carries all this additional weight that makes it hard to just drop
but,
it.
But you're not thinking really, are you?
No.
You're not actually thinking.
No.
In other words, you know, thinking in the first sense that I was talking about is sort of deliberating possible outcomes.
Yeah.
Based on a variety of variables being organized in a certain way. So in a sense you're doing like, you're moving pieces around on a board to see which one might create either the truest or the most beautiful or the most convenient pattern.
Mm-hmm.
That feels like a kind of a certain kind of thinking.
Yeah.
This intrusive thought, this what if, that feels like you're not thinking, are you?
I think that would be a good argument.
So what are you doing?
Yeah.
What's happening? What does it feel like? Is it just someone talking in your head and then you can't control their talking? But it's you, obviously, but is it like a waking dream that you can't wake up from, like you can't get out of?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the other options? What are the other...
I don't know. I was just kind of looking for you to describe the experience and how it's different from other thought experiences. Mm-hmm. There are certain, there are all kinds of ways that thought manifests mm-hmm. itself. And I was just looking at, I was just kind of asking a question.
I mean, I think it feels very like narrow and pinpointed on the thing. And maybe, and there's something about the unconcealedness, and that it's very like...
What about the unconcealedness? Why does that word ring for
very,
you?
It feels very like...
Like a curtain's been ripped away and now you see this horror and you can't take your eye off it?
I would say it's more just that like... The like, it's like very brash, I think is the word I used earlier, just very like bare and mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. like there's not subtlety, there's mm-hmm. not like mm-hmm. ambiguity, it's just like there mm-hmm. as, yeah,
mm-hmm.
there's no like room for, there's no room for anything. I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Other than it.
Yeah, I mean, it takes over your mind, right? Like, you can't stop thinking about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it totally depends. There, every single one, I think, is different. But yes, sometimes, yes, it's very repetitive.
Sometimes, yeah.
And worrisome, or yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree, and we've thought about it not being thought. I think there's a good argument there that it's not intrusive and it's not thinking or thought, thought or thinking. But I'm not sure what it is.
Right, then, and the question is what it is. What is it?
Like, I mean, words in your head. Is that the definition of thinking or not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we started this whole section of Heidegger here, you know, with in a sense, talking about thinking. It's 102, right? Thinking, the guideline of the guiding question.
Mm-hmm.
And we started by talking about it as anticipatory apprehension and gathering mm-hmm. of the unconcealedness of what emergent is in constantly present as such. I mean, anticipatory apprehension is an interesting phrase when we're talking about thinking as like, that's kind of what I was talking about is considering possible outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
That's anticipatory apprehension, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm thinking about what could occur
mm-hmm.
if X, Y, and Z occur
mm-hmm.
in ways A, B, and C. And then you even go to the point where it's like, well, if I change A to D and that replaces B and C, then I have to add F, then will X, Y, and Z still be the, you know, it's mm-hmm. all this sort of the juggling of possibilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we start there with thinking as that. And then we get into this sort of this difference between truth and correctness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we end up at what we end up, what he seems to be implying is kind of a perhaps a different sense of what thinking is, and we come to think of it as, and we come to see it as in a way the eyes, the transcendental eyes, unification of nature into singular beings, or aka objects, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the eye uses what it calls thought to create objects.
Yeah.
And so this is this unity thing, and then we get, and then he moves into identity,
mm-hmm.
and he says, so, you know, in the transcendental eyes, thinking as unification, we then end up with unities as identities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the I becomes an identity itself through knowledge of self, and then identities are kind of propagating everywhere, and nature becomes a cluster of identities. The I is an identity, and all the I's are identical to each other, and they become indifferent to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And knowledge is kind of the medium or the arbiter or the enabler of all this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, somewhere in that whole archaeology that he just did as to how we've gotten to this point where the I is, as he says, the preeminent identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the knowledge of itself is the supreme identity, and it's self-appertaining. And where absolute knowledge becomes absolute reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge as self-knowledge is the highest identity, the most proper being.
Mm-hmm.
And then the I starts, what is other than the I becomes visible spirit. Somewhere in there, right, is I think a really critical and valuable glimpse into the experience of being able to even say that there are non-intrusive and intrusive thoughts, and to even sort of be able to demarcate them and be troubled by one and empowered by the other, in a sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the content of non-intrusive and intrusive thoughts is less causal in the designation of them as non-intrusive and intrusive,
mm-hmm.
and instead is almost an evolved symptom of these two, this binary of thinking that you have,
mm-hmm.
that we have,
mm-hmm.
in non-intrusive and intrusive, mm-hmm. that the content of bad and good has just kind of developed secondarily to fall into these two categories.
Mm-hmm.
And that bad and good are symptoms of a kind of deeper desire,
mm-hmm.
or a deeper penchant for or addiction to this self-knowledge that forms identity and mm-hmm. sees identity everywhere and makes identity indifference, and has turned the world into an enforced community of indifference. And it's a natural reaction to this enforced community of indifference to have this binary of non-intrusive and intrusive thought,
mm-hmm.
and to have aggregated the bad into intrusive and the good into non-intrusive,
and wanted and unwanted,
the wanted and the unwanted, yeah. Exactly. Feels like a symptom of identity,
yeah.
as a result of self-knowledge somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting.
I don't know how, but it feels like somehow it's the result of this community of indifference that identity has become as a result of the transcendental I in viewing self-knowledge as the arbiter of what we call objects and beings.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, I would say, it's almost like, first of all, indifference is completely, I'm going to use this word, unnatural. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Identity is completely, there is no identity in nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very arguable assertion, but we can imagine that, we can think that way. We can say that the identity machine that the transcendental I of the human being is posits, at least phantasmagorically, the idea that it is outside of nature. Mm-hmm. And to be phantasmagorically outside of nature is, in a certain sense, to be outside of nature. Mm-hmm. At least outside of the nature that one says one is outside of, but yet one is also in nature. Mm-hmm. So there's a nature that is repelled via phantasmagoria, and then there's a nature that one then exists in as a result of phantasmagoria. And this is the phantasmagoria of identity and self-knowledge again. And so there you see that the obtrusive thoughts, the intrusive thoughts, are that nature that is rejected by the phantasmagoria of identity, mm-hmm. and the nature that the phantasmagoricizing identity is in becomes non-intrusive thought. Mm-hmm. And it's all as a result of the compulsion of the creation of identity via the I that creates unities to know beings so it can know itself and have objects and avoid truth, mm-hmm. due to its preference for the comfort of correctness.
Yeah.
And correctness, you know, in the absence of truth, we have correctness, right?
Yeah.
And this intrusive and non-intrusive thinking realms, these realms of two types of thinking, are also, in a sense, the symptoms of the predominance of correctness, mm-hmm. over and against truth. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the non-intrusive and the intrusive thoughts that you're having are all true. Mm-hmm. They're both true. But there's a sort of a sense in which one is correct and one is incorrect. Mm-hmm. Or one supports your indifference of identity and one does not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is kind of part and parcel of saying that, you know, what this book is calling us to do is to deconstruct this transcendental I, this identity regime, mm-hmm. this obsession of self-knowledge, this mm-hmm. creation of this, in a sense, this fabrication of unity as the making up of beings and objects, mm-hmm. In order to serve the transcendental I, that this machine creates the dichotomy between intrusive and non-intrusive thinking. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When both, I would put forward that intrusive and non-intrusive thoughts are the exact same thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're the exact same. They're both something. Mm-hmm. Call it thinking now, but one is, you know, there's two kinds of trains, right? Trains that are being driven and trains that aren't being driven. Some trains are out of control, right? They're the brakes are not going to go on. The conductor has had a heart attack and is lying face down on the floor, and the train is not going to stop until it hits something. That's a train. Then there's the train where the conductor has not had a heart attack, you know? So
yeah, but that has a value. Huh? That has sort of a value judgment on it, I guess, or good and bad.
Well, I was trying to say that I think we can call non-intrusive and intrusive thinking or thoughts both thoughts.
Yeah.
I think it's acceptable that they're thoughts. I mean, because I think we just kind of almost got to this point where we're saying intrusive thoughts aren't thoughts, because they don't seem to match what we call thoughts, which are non-intrusive thoughts that feel very agential.
Yeah.
But guess what? I'm not sure those thoughts are as agential as we think they are. Both thoughts are probably simply the emanations of covert compulsions that we would prefer not to think of as causative towards thinking, because we've become conditioned and we've become conditioned to the idea that our eye is thinking and it's creating objects and the world exists because we do that. But again, how agential is the eye? I mean, that's very Freudian. So we're stuck in this, kind of question, the question of truth, the question of being, the question of thought, the question of agency, the question of inside and outside, the question of what's coming from inside, what's coming from outside, the question of compulsion versus freedom. And the question of how living under the guise and the rule of identity, if and how it allows for us to even come to choose what we might call intrusion or nativism. What's inside you? What's outside you? What are you choosing? What are you not choosing? How can you know, when we say I'm having a thought, how can you know it's you that are having it? But, you know, I think it, what a lot of people would say to that, they would say, well, I have self-knowledge. I am self-knowledge. And the only response to that is kind of like, but how do you know? Knowledge that knows itself and only knows that it knows itself because it is knowledge and it knows is ungrounded.
I mean, it seems that this kind of way of thinking about thinking kind of makes it all sort of irrelevant, I guess.
Makes what irrelevant?
If you say intrusive thoughts and non-intrusive thoughts, and they're all the same and they're all just different ways of thinking, then it's sort of like, well, then kind of all our thinking is a little like, I don't know, fabricated, not real.
Yeah, I was going to kind of go the same place, and I was going to say, I think that all this talk, of thinking as being kind of like a phantasm, or like you say, fabricated, or just like fake, or an illusion, or an irrelevancy, or just a shadow or a symptom of something else that's more important. I think that the one response there is but I'm very afraid sometimes. Sometimes I really feel scared. Like, some thoughts really scare me, and some thoughts don't scare me at all. I actually really enjoy them. Which is why I kind of started the whole conversation with sort of like, so beyond saying these thoughts, I really enjoy this kind of thinking, and this kind of thinking scares the shit out of me. Beyond just the experience of enjoyment and fear, and we all kind of know what the difference between enjoyment and fear is, but I'm not sure we could actually describe it, right? If you elevate fear thinking and enjoyment thinking out of just being indescribably enjoyable and indescribably scary, is there a phenomenal experience whereby they are somehow different, not both just thinking or not just both just an emotion or experience, as to where they're coming from, as to how they feel tied into agency. I don't know, if we could just kind of identify some kind of difference between them, then we might be able to start. I think that they're kind of stuck in this community of indifference too, you know. They're like identical. Thinking is thinking. I don't know, like there's something there and I don't know what it is. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, we've talked about it in terms of, I mean, with intrusive thoughts, it does definitely feel like it's a repeating of a script or like a bad movie or a plot line or something. It doesn't feel like a creative unique.
Right.
It feels like personal or agential thinking, but like, I mean, maybe the same could be said of the other kind of thinking, normal thinking. But you know, it's just. But I don't know. I'm not sure that's really a...
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a fair...
Yeah. Thing. Yeah, I hear that. I think we can say for certain...
And I mean, I think you were saying, like, it comes back to the identity. Is it, like, kind of...
Yes, that's exactly what I was about to say. But keep going. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, actually, probably, you know, one is, as a therapist would say, ego dystonic, so it goes against who you think you are.
Yes.
And the other is ego syntonic,
yes,
which goes alongside what you think you are. So
yes,
when it's ego or identity dystonic, it brings up,
yes,
so much other. It kind of enters a different,
yes, realm. That's exactly what I was gonna say. We're very on the same page tonight. Like, I think If you remember that all of this is taking place within the I know myself,
yeah,
I knowing itself, the self knowledge as the supreme being,
mm-hmm,
and understand that that's not just a fact. It's a compulsion. It's almost like an electromagnetic force. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. Identity is an electromagnetic force. And when that electromagnetic force is being pulled at,
mm-hmm,
tension, anxiety, fear occur.
Yeah.
So it's all rooted in identity as the electromagnetic force of the human mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's like... because it's going against the identity.
Yeah, and it's challenging. I mean, identity is the outcome of self-knowledge, and it's challenging that little empire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. How to? I mean, I think it's banal to then be like, well, you just need to be looser with your identity. Like, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
How does that even, and is that really even a good idea? And you know, but I think that with what Heidegger is kind of getting at in this whole section, I think that, I think we really like. We probably paranoiacally hyper-exaggerate the idea of identity dissolution.
Mm-hmm.
I think identity dissolution is actually super hard and probably doesn't happen all that often.
Yeah.
But I think we're all running around all day long acting as if our identity could crumble at any minute and then everything would just go absolutely haywire.
Yeah.
But I'd like to... anybody to show me a single case where somebody's identity actually crumbled.
Yeah.
We're all actually so locked into this projecting unity of being onto the world,
mm-hmm,
via the supreme being of the I that knows itself, that like to get out of that is like, I mean, three people in all of history have gotten out of that, you know. I don't know, isn't that what Nirvana is like? Only Buddha.
But isn't that sort of the goal of this myth book of him.
Yeah, well, the goal of this book is the first beginning and the future ones and the leap and you know, yeah, that's all what this book is. That's why this is a liberationist text, as I say.
Yeah.
This book is a liberationist manual for a post-identity Dasein.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow, but it is that roadmap.
Yeah.
And why? Why take that road, that very, 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 very hard road? To achieve a life where there's no intrusive and non-intrusive thoughts. Mm-hmm. Where one is this massive cluster of the awful that you can't get rid of, right?
Yeah.
And one is this massive cluster of the agential, which actually is kind of maybe not agential, right? So yeah. you really just got the two really bad, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Neither of them are super good at really being good for us.
Yeah.
But that's the fruits of identity.
Yeah.
So congratulations, everybody.
Yeah.
All right, I guess that's it. Right?
Yeah.
Well, then, good night.
Good night. Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.